is not only knowing what you're looking for your sake, but knowing exactly what you're looking for so that you can effectively, I mean, train everybody else to bring you exactly what you're looking for. And that saves them time and it saves you time.
Hello, everybody. This is Jake Senzi, host of the Jake and Gino podcast, here with my co-host, multifamily mentor, the coach, chef, father, six, best-selling author, the G-Daddy, Gino Barbaro. Gino, how's it going?
Stenzi.
Yes, sir.
Great day. I'm on a podcast with you today. Can't get any better. How you doing?
It's Friday, dude. I didn't think we were doing these things on Friday, but we're just, you know, we're just getting pushed. You know, we're not living our values here. We're just being pushed at the, you know, by the
I
team
I beg to
here.
Differ. Make
the
it
team
happen.
Is just pushing us, man.
That's the values, right?
Ask me how I'm doing.
How you doing?
Always making it happen, big man. Today we have former chemical engineer turned real estate entrepreneur. He left the corporate world to start flipping single family properties and has now successfully syndicated and repositioned over 2,000 multifamily units. We got a multifamily entrepreneur on the show today. So without further ado, Andrew Cushman, welcome to the show.
Hey, good to be here, guys. Appreciate it. Even on a Friday.
We're gonna help some folks today. And you know, you Andrew are going to help some people. You're going to be a man of the people today. All right.
I'll do my best.
We want to hear from you about your transition from W-2 engineer to multifamily entrepreneur. Okay. We want to talk about the things that happened in your life that can benefit the people. All right. Man of the people, Andrew Cushman, go.
All right. Well, like you said, I took the traditional path into real estate and got a chemical engineering degree. The reason I did that is because I knew I wanted to do my own thing, but I had no clue what that was going to be. So I figured if I was an engineer, I could at least have a good job until I figured it out. So got my degree, went to work for a food company, a few years, eventually got married. My wife had the same idea, same mentality. It was Cargill, huge, like, oh, they're like, really kind of like, yeah, they're like the largest privately held company in North America. They're like the behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. I think something like 75% of what we eat has an ingredient from them in it. Right.
So yeah, what did the guy say the other day, Gino, like from all the food in the country, like it's five companies, right?
I believe it.
Yeah.
So they were a great company to work for. I had no complaints, but again, it wasn't what I really wanted to do. And so my wife and I got together and we started like all kinds of random businesses. We looked into vending. She made shirts and sold them online. We took a weekend and destroyed our kitchen.
Did you look into healthy vending?
We just looked into any kind of vending.
I looked into healthy vending back in like 08, by the way.
Oh, did you?
Just
okay.
Like, and I'm just like, shit, man.
This was 2006 and 7 when we were looking at that. Yeah. And each one of those things made a little bit of money, but we're like, okay, this is just gonna be another job. And it's probably gonna be worse than the jobs we have. And then I was walking through the break room one day, saw a Wall Street Journal article about flipping houses. And I picked it up, took it home. I was like, hey, maybe we could do that, right? We're in Southern California. My wife read it and said, okay, great. So we went and we actually, the guy in the article had learned it from a, I don't want to say guru, but someone who was teaching it locally here in California. So we went and read everything she had. I didn't want to spend the money to pay for the course, but my wife convinced me to do it. So I said, okay, fine. I went and took the course. And then the gist of it was it involved calling people. This is again 2006, 2007, 2008, pre and during financial crisis, calling people in pre-foreclosure, trying to help them save their house. But if they couldn't save it, we were there to buy it, right? And you know, I was a chemical engineer. My skill set was not having conversations on the phone. And, you know, we're making cold calls saying, hey, you don't know me, but let's talk about your financial problems, right? So that's usually not the warmest intro. So it took me 4,576 of those calls to get my first deal. But when I did, and we flipped
it,
4,576.
And how are you recording these numbers?
I just kept a spreadsheet. I'm a big believer. I'm an engineer. I do numbers. I try to be fact-based and take, you know, so I'm like, I just kept, because well, here's the thing. I believed in the real estate. I believed in the business and I believed in the systems. And I knew that at the end of the day, it was up to me to execute it. And if I could get myself to the point where I was good enough to execute it, it would work. That's one of the things I love about real estate as a business. I'm not a creative guy, right? With real estate, you can do R&D, rip off and duplicate. You just learn, see how someone else is is doing it, learn that and go execute. And you don't have to figure it out, right? Everybody, it's figured out. Real estate is figured out. There's nothing new. You just got to go learn it and then execute. And so that's what I loved about it. And I knew if I just stuck with it, it would eventually work. So that first deal when we flipped it, it was a condo. I made as much as I made all year at my job. And it was a scary time in the economy. This was late 2007 when we flipped it and sold that thing. But we said, you know what? If we don't do it now, we may never do it. So I went into my boss and into his office, closed the door. I remember my arms were shaking as I was leaning on his desk, right? Because I had worked really hard. I had a
good so
job.
you're like posturing up on him. You're leaning in and saying, I'm gonna get you, man.
Well, what I was say to him? I had a good, but we were friends. I was just nervous. I had worked really, really hard to get this fairly cushy job, right? Nice engineering job, 10 minutes from my house, no big commute, no traffic, none of that. And here I am gonna quit and just walk out.
Because you flipped the condo.
Yeah, because I flipped a condo, one, right? But, you know, it's just, again, it's like we realized, okay, this takes a lot of work, so we're going to have to commit to it. So, yeah, I walked in, and you know, I didn't just bail on him. I gave him 6 weeks, and then it took six more months to get that second deal. And then by a year or two, we got good at it. The deal started flowing. But then in 2009, 10, and 11, we were like, hey, this is great, but it's actually another really hard job. And we said, what can we do that is at scale but builds lasting wealth? And what's going to do really well going forward? And we're like, okay, well, everyone just got foreclosed on. They can't buy a house, which means they're going to go rent. And we just had a huge recession, which means we're probably going to have a long expansion. So if you put expansion with a buttload of renters, that means rental property is probably going to do well. Let's go learn apartments. We hired a mentor. We found the guy who knew who had done 800 units. We said, hey, will you teach us? He agreed. And then our first deal was mostly vacant 92 unit piece of junk on the other side of the country in Macon, Georgia. And it was a rough.
Did you buy a deal from Bill Hamm? Bill?
I do know Bill. It was just down the street from one of his. Just down the street.
You probably
from
paid 20 a door for that thing back then.
I paid $7,500 a door.
Look, I'm sorry. It's not worth 70 a door now, probably, right?
Yeah. Actually, it's back on the market for like 48. Yeah. I didn't have the money to do that, so we syndicated it. It was profitable, but like I said, I learned a lot. That deal is what made my hair half gray, like it is today. But
Macon, man, there's some stories coming out of Macon, Georgia, baby. Holy crap.
Yeah. So
it's where boys become men as investors. Oh,
you're not kidding. You're not kidding. So we don't do those kind of deals anymore, but it's what got us here. So
Andrew Cushman with the cushy job, and he's leaving his cushy job. Hey, the personification of behaviors are belief driven. I mean, 4,576 calls. I would have quit after about 2,000. It seems like it would have taken you 6 years to make all those phone calls. I mean, I would have quit. But everyone, there's a joke to it. But if you believe you can do it, you're eventually going to do it. That's the bottom line. I know in his engineer, he's probably saying, I got to make 300 calls a week, blah, blah, blah. That's what you need to do. If you can believe you can do it and you find the right mentor and you find the right vehicle, you stack all of those together, then things start happening. But if you're not in the belief of it, and Andrew,
how long to get that first multifamily deal, Gino, real quick? Because it took us 2 years to get ours. You made 4 bazillion calls to get your first flip. How long did it take from when the time you started looking at multifamily until you got that first deal in Macon?
I think it was 6 to 8 months.
Okay.
I want to hear the emotions, like the decision-making, because we've gotten a lot of this before. Like, how did you leave the restaurant? How did you leave the pharmaceutical rep industry? How did you make that decision, honestly, without having any kind of like plan going forward? What was that like between you and your wife, that conversation?
You mean the transition to quit my W-2 and going to flipping?
Yeah, absolutely.
One thing that we did and I found really helpful is it's human nature to, and I'm going to pronounce this word wrong. I still can't spell entrepreneur, and I've been one for over a decade. But
entrepreneur.
Yeah,
it's human manure.
Yeah, there you go. There's a lot of manure involved. We tend to catastrophize, right, or go to the worst case scenario. In reality is if make two columns and say, well, what are the potential benefits or upsides of making this change? And you say, well, freedom of our own time, unlimited potential income. We get to help people and improve housing. What are the downsides? Well, the downside is It doesn't work, and I go find another job. Okay, that's actually the only real downside, right? Mm-hmm. So when you write them down on paper, and then even say, okay, what is the worst case scenario? All right, it fails, I lose 20 grand, and now I need a new job. Is that really the end of the world compared to the potential upside? No, I mean, obviously you don't want that to happen, but so we wrote down the
pros. Can I jump in just for a quick second on that? Because guys, think about what he's saying. It's like the Ben Franklin thing. You get the list, you divide the side like pros and cons. But the thing that you're leaving out there that's is vitally important is if you did fail in multifamily, what did you learn from that? And can you correct it? So on round two at your next at bat, do you get it right at that point? Because this shit is not rocket science. And that's the piece you're missing there. I just want to throw that out there to people. You take another at bat after you lose in the first one. Correct where you messed up. Buy right, manage right, and finance right. You put parameters in place for those things. This stuff is not rocket science. I just want to be very clear on that. So,
yeah, you're absolutely rough deal. But part of why we have so much success today is because all the stuff that we learned on that, and we use that to change what we did going forward. And then that makes for a much stronger, healthier, profitable, easier business now.
What did you change going forward?
We created that deal plus a few others after. We created a screening procedure where we run every deal through that we have a minimum requirement for median income. We have minimum requirements for population growth. We have requirements regarding flood zones, requirements regarding crime. We analyze what the neighbors are. I mean, there's a whole list of procedures to make sure that we are buying a property that is in an area where we have a strong tailwind. And that's going to either increase the chances of success or multiply the profits when we are successful.
So Jake is telling me buy right 101. Jake, you want to elaborate on what buy right 101 is?
This is buy right 101, folks. Welcome to class. I am your host and teacher, Jake Stenziano. Now, buy right 101 is exactly what he just described. We look to set this up to make a duplicatable process in everything we do. Buy right, manage right, and finance right. So he put parameters in place for the buy side. Okay, I'm sure he has certain metrics that he needs to hit for each one of those things he just listed. And now he goes out, knows what the market they're looking for, know what kind of deal, know what kind of vintage. And he's simply sifting for gold, okay? Brokers are feeding him deals. He's putting it through the machine, seeing what shakes out and seeing what hits his parameters. And then he's able to act quickly, maybe while he still has a W-2 job. He already quit because he's gangster. But if you're still in a W-2 job and you're sifting for the gold, you're systematizing it and making the process easy and duplicatable. So you're not going in 14 different markets when you first start off. You can really focus, get in with those brokers, start getting some deal flow and find something that works.
And Yaki Boomba, one of the worst words that we like to hear, that we hate hearing, is maybe. So Andrew's parameters are either yes or no, not maybe. And as an entrepreneur, the manure, you're focusing, you could say yes real quick. And if it's a no, you're out of there, right? And you're not wasting any time. Jake and I were looking at a deal for months and months and months. It's the biggest pain when someone's saying maybe and they're on the fence. It's okay if you say no to me, I'll be able to move on. But that focus is truly, I mean, it's truly important when you're out looking at a deal. If it doesn't fit your parameter, and more importantly, Andrew, I'm sure the brokers out there are bringing you the deals that you have highlighted for them so they know exactly what you're looking at, correct?
Yeah, that's another key point that you're bringing up is it's not only knowing what you're looking for your sake, but knowing exactly what you're looking for so that you can train everybody else to bring you exactly what you're looking for. And that saves them time and it saves you time.
Yes.
And what happens is we're talking about brokers. The broker talks with the seller and he talks with, the seller's like, okay, yeah, I might take an offer. And, Gino, you've trained that broker. That broker knows exactly what you're looking for. And that broker goes, oh, you know what? This deal is perfect for Gino. I'm just going to call him right now. Mm-hmm. Right. And it worked. And you end up being the only person who ever saw that deal. You mm-hmm. buy it and not a single person even knew it was going on.
Love that. Let's discuss about what's going on in this current market, because we're talking about limiting beliefs between Jake, Andrew, and Gino. Price points, where we're seeing things going and how you've evolved your buy rate criteria, because it's not stagnant. It's ever flowing. We're changing. We're trying to stay up with the times. Asset prices are increasing, inflation. What are you looking at right now in the market?
Well, as far as, we still use our screening procedure, the median income and all of that, as far as picking markets and locations. That hasn't really changed, other than we've had to adjust the median income upward a little bit. But in terms of, you mentioned like price point, it's definitely been a psychological change over the last few years. You know, we mentioned I started buying at $7,500 a unit. And, you know, now to see that selling for 40 something, we purchased one in March for 197 a unit. And which to me, I never imagined paying that kind of price for real estate. And so it's like, well, geez, you know, how can you pay that much? Is it worth it? Are you worried about the prices going down? It's all a factor of adjusting parameters for not only where the market overall is going, right, but also the submarket that you're in. So yeah, we paid 197 a unit for it, but that property is the best performing property that we've gotten. Mm-hmm. And the reason
high
being,
demand. High
yeah,
demand.
Because
people
it's in
want
a,
it.
It's in a super high demand market. It's a super high demand product within that market. And, you know, let's see, we closed in March. It's, and we're talking now in early August. So that's 5 months, right? In 5 months with a light renovation, I'm talking like 45 to 6,500 a unit. We've increased rents $412 a month per unit, right? On that property. And so the cash flow and valuation on that has already dramatically increased, even though we started at
beyond expectations, would you say?
Oh, far beyond expectations. Yeah. Yeah. We could probably sell it today, 5 months later, for more than we planned on exiting 5 years from now. And part of that is the market did shift even more aggressively than we thought, but that gets back to putting yourself in the right markets where stuff, quote unquote, unexpected shifts like that, are more likely to happen to your benefit.
Are you considering it? Hot potato? Get out. Someone take it.
No, we're not. Because we've got great cash flow and we'd have a big, you know, you guys talk about financing, right? A whole lot. Right. And so when we went under contract on this, it was back in December. The world was a lot more uncertain back in December. We were still in the depths of COVID winter and all that kind of thing. So we said, all right, you know,
that should be a Marvel movie, by the way.
Yeah, COVID winter. That'd actually make a great, yeah. that's a really good idea. So, you know, I hear you guys in the back of my head, finance it, right? That's the one of the three legs. And so what we did is with an uncertain future, we put 12-year fixed debt on it because we wanted to hold for 6 years. And then what that let us do is we can either, if rates go up, we're fixed for 12 years, no problem. If rates go down, we can keep holding, or that if rates go down, cap rates are probably also down, which means we can sell at a huge profit. Mm-hmm. Or if rates go up, we can sell on assumption, meaning somebody can take over our fixed low rate loan and then they can get a supplemental and get levered back up to 75%, right?
So is that where you came in at 75?
Yeah, we came in at 75. And then if it goes up, someone else can come in and readjust.
And pretty new product. So your rental budget, CapEx budget was probably, you know, coming in was minimal, right?
Yeah, it was pretty low. And there was no deferred maintenance. It was all upgrades. The average year of construction on that was 2011. Mm-hmm. So what we did is we bought right, but then we structured the finance so that we felt like we'd have a good exit almost no matter what the market conditions were 6 years down the road. I mean, we all like to predict and say, okay, this is, but no, I can't, there's no way.
Through that long-term fixed rate financing, I don't care. I know everyone likes their Freddy floaters or whatever the hell they call them. It sounds like a turd in the toilet. Look, you want to get, I like long-term fixed rate financing. I don't care. Like we have stuff that we were in at like 4 and now it's like, oh, you can get 3.5. I don't give a shit. It worked at the time at that point, and I got it fixed for 10 or 12, maybe 15 years now, and I'm very happy holding it. So.
Hey, Jake, I thought this was a multifamily podcast. We got turned the toilet, COVID winter. We got ideas for movies here. I mean,
we're just trying to keep it real, Broseph, all right?
Andrew, I'm not going to talk about turning the toilets. I want to talk about your inflection points in your life because yeah. You're going from 7,500 a door. And I'll give you an example. You're looking at the two IMA guys. I'm a do this and I'm a do that. And I'm a chainsaw guy and I'm a cutting the grass kind of guy. And discuss with me a couple of inflection points that you had on your journey in multifamily investing from getting that first deal to maybe hiring a third-party property management or bringing on partners or hiring. What inflection points really helped you to get to where you are today?
Yeah, you know, that's really good. And I don't think anyone's ever asked me that question that way before.
You got to come on the Jake and Gino show for these
welcome
questions,
to the
my
bigs.
Friend.
Welcome to the bigs, dog.
You guys asked the right stuff. So, Yeah. So there's a hand, if I think about it, I can think of at least three inflection point, important inflection points that would be, I'd say would be important to anyone getting started. One was doing that first deal, realizing, okay, I don't have the money for this. But that doesn't mean I shouldn't do the deal. I just got to go find the money. And that's how I got into syndication is because, you know, it was a $1.2 million deal total, including renovation and everything, because this is 2011. It was a lot cheaper back then, but I didn't have that money. So I had to go syndicate it. And if someone out there can do it without syndicating, strongly consider doing it without syndicating. Because that, you know, if you've been listening to Jake and Gino for a long time, you'll know that gives you some options and flexibility and wealth that syndicating doesn't, right? But most of us don't have the ability to or patience to do it. So number one was, okay, if I'm going to go into big assets, I'm going to have to syndicate. That was number one. Number two is it took me 6 months, an incredible amount of stress to get that deal closed. I underestimated how hard it was to raise that money back in 2011 when people were scared of real estate and I didn't have that big of a network. So
the track record was lacking.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'd done some single family, but I hadn't done any multifamily yet, right? So those things combined made it really hard to raise it. And so after the first deal, I said, okay, the deal was good and I like this business, but I don't want to go through that again. So I did an inflection point, said, let's go to partner, right? Because the first deal, I was everything. I was every hat. I was all of it. And so I actually went to the guy who had taught me that I was learning the business from and said, hey, if I find another really good deal, will you guys partner? He had another partner. Will you guys partner with us or with me and help raise the money and we'll do some deals together? And he's like, yeah, we can do that. The next couple of deals were that way, where I found the deal, helped raise some money. They filled the rest, right? So that led the next few deals. And we at that early point, another inflection point is we were basically self-managing. They kind of had their own in-house management and we'd do it all. And we quickly realized that, you know, self-management is good for learning management so that you can become a good asset manager down the road. And yes, no one cares about your property like you do, but what we learned is caring does not equal competence, right? Mm-hmm. If your spouse needs an operation and she goes in to the OR, you're not going to walk in there, put your hand on the doc's shoulder and, hey, you know what? Yeah, I got this. I love her more than you do.
Unless you want to kill her. Unless you kill her.
That's a different movie.
Number three, we got three ideas.
Right? So caring does not equal competence. And in property management is not hard to do a mediocre job at, but it is hard to do really, really good job at. So what we did is we went through a really long, detailed process to find the right property management partner, a third party company that we could work with like partners. They're not just okay.
Tell us about their footprint.
So when we hired them, the two founders had come out of large corporate property management companies. They felt like they could do a better job than those big companies. And they had founded their own. At the time we hired them, they had about 3,000 units. And we felt like, hey, we can grow together. And so now they're at close to 30,000 units. They stick to the region that they're in, the same region that we are. And what I found is, you know, in addition to them being the right partners in terms of they care about us, they care about our people, they care about our properties, when you're partnering with a third party management company that has 20 or 30,000 units, you leverage their relationships, right? They can get better pricing with vendors. In a market like today, where it's really hard to get vendors to come work, period, they can get a contractor for us because they carry a lot of weight, right? They've got, you know, they manage.
They're almost like a developer, a builder with that kind of scale. So they're feeding these people day in and day out. And this is the other thing, folks, if you're just getting into the business, there are contractors, vendors, whatever you want to say, that just work in the multifamily space.
Yep.
So sometimes you're getting in and you're like, sometimes having that relationship, to Andrew's point, they're going to know those people already. And they're going to basically, lessen that, slow down that learning curve, shorten it, whatever you want to say, to find the people that actually work in the space. Because what I pay to paint this place, my house, is not nearly the same that I'm paying to paint a apartment per square foot. It's just not. Okay.
Nope,
and these
right.
people understand right that it's a different world. So that's huge, man.
Yeah. So that was an inflection point of, you know, getting out of the weeds of property management and going from property management to asset management. Now, property management is okay. At 3 o'clock, I got to sign the lease for the lady in unit 3A, right? That's property management. Asset management is having a weekly call with your property manager and your property management company and setting the vision and the direction for the property, saying, hey, by the end of the year, we'd like to get rents up to here. Here's the renovation budget. Here's how we want to spend it. We're going to do this over the next 3 years. We have a refinance coming up in, 8 months. And so we need to make sure that, the financials reflect this. And, that's asset management, the big picture stuff. And especially as an investor and as an entrepreneur, that is where the higher dollar value is building the business, kind of setting the vision for it, and then bringing in somebody who's really good at and likes that day to day. And candidly, every one of our property managers, they run those properties better than I would if I was there.
For everyone listening, take note. That's a very important point that Andrew makes. Here's the property management company. Here's the asset management company. They're two different. They're at times confrontational. The property manager wants to put a $300 ceiling fan. The asset manager wants a $70 ceiling fan. He wants to get it done for the cheapest point. They have to meet in the middle. They really have to have really great communication. When Jake and I were buying our properties in the beginning, we sort of blended the two together. We weren't thinking as asset managers. We were only thinking at it from the property management side. So I think the huge golden nugget from this one is segregate both. Even if you're doing both, put on different hats, because the asset manager will allow you to think like an entrepreneur because you're scaling a business. And that's very, very important.
The great description too. I really enjoyed the description and the key takeaway there, and everyone needs to be doing this. Have that weekly meeting. Okay. We call it a level 10 meeting. It was something that we got out of, I think that was EOS when we were doing that one, and then break it down. You have your core, you have your quarterly planning session. We're at the top. Here's the things that we're getting pulled through this quarter. Reverse engineer it. Here are the tasks. That's how it's going to go. And then don't overload the folks. Don't be the Jake and Gino, from 2012 when we took a machine gun and went in a flamethrower and Gino had like the bandana, like Rambo, swinging and like stabbing people, right? You just got to take it easy, get very clear on 2 to 3, maybe 4 really good priorities, and then execute well on them so you're not freaking your staff out.
Well, that's it's funny you say that because they always tell me that I plug in at nighttime and I do a machine. I have 6 kids. We homeschool the whole thing. I'm a busy guy. I prioritize. When I get something on my desk, I get it done. I don't wait till tomorrow or the next day. And most people can't do that. I'm not on Facebook. I'm not on Instagram. I'm on work mode. I'm on obsession mode. Right, Jake? That's how it's going to be. Yeah. And most people are like, no, we're entrepreneurs. We're working 24/7.
Just do it.
Yeah. So
who's our boy? Who's our boy?
Just do it and do it. Mr. Art Williams, my friend.
Oh, got it. If you haven't listened, if you didn't get anything out of this entire podcast, go watch Art Williams' speech from like the late 80s. It'll change your life. All right.
Just do it. Don't make any excuses. I'm tired. Just do it. Andrew, last question. It's not about turds. Let me ask you about your mentality. Your whole, now that you've got these inflection points, you're looking back from the beginning, how have your goals as an investor, I guess, changed or evolved? Because Jake and I did a podcast yesterday about reading Stephen Covey 15 years ago, and we got nothing out of the book. It's like, what the hell is this guy even talking about? Now reading it a year ago, it's like, wow, I wish I had read this 15 years ago.
This guy's like the Dalai Lama here, right?
It's like, you read it today and it's like, wow, if you're looking back at it, you're going to talk to yourself as a young investor. What would you tell your young investor right now, knowing everything that you know right now?
Oh, wow. That could be a lot, but I would say one of the,
buy everything in 2012.
Well, I don't.
Yeah, that I mean, candidly, that's the first thing that I was like, yeah, just buy everything you saw in 2012 to 2015, right? But unfortunately, since none of us can do that, that people that were like, no, thanks, Andrew, that's really helpful. One of the mistakes that I made, and I think I'm more prone to this than a lot of entrepreneurs, but it definitely runs strong in the entrepreneur circle, is I was the guy wearing every hat, doing everything for far too long. I waited way too long to bring in other people and other partners. I probably would have done more real estate and done it with less work and less stress if I had brought more people on. And part of my limiting belief that hindered me from bringing someone on is I kind of had this thing of, well, I either don't want or can't, pay someone 120 grand a year to do this, or I can't. And that's not correct. That's not true. Number one, I would encourage anyone who's like, well, yeah, I could use more time, but I can't afford to hire anybody. The one thing I would say is you're not, it's not an annual commitment, right? If you do hire someone for W-2, it can, in 2-3 months down the road, you can be, hey, you know what? Unfortunately, this isn't working out, right? Mm-hmm. So you're not out a $100,000 a year salary. You're out 2 or 3 months of it, right? The second thing is there's other ways to do it. You can partner and say, well, hey, look, you know what? You bring these factors to the business. I bring these factors to the business, and we'll split the proceeds and the profits, right? So you can partner or joint venture. You can add principals. The other thing is, candidly, my first hire was a very smart, hardworking, beautiful wife, right? She became my business partner and handled a bunch of other stuff so I could focus on those 4,500 phone calls.
Marry up.
Got yeah, it. No, definitely. Yeah, marry up. That helps, right? So, and I.
It's not hard for us, Jake. I'm sorry.
But I mean, there's truth to that. But also, you know, something simple like, and it's almost embarrassing. It took me years and years to do this, hiring somebody else to come mow and blow the yard every week instead of me doing it. Well, okay, I can, you know, if I look at the dollar value of, if I get another deal, whether a flip or an apartment complex, by taking that hour and spending it on the business instead of mowing the yard, mm-hmm. That's hiring people out. That's bringing people onto the team. And so you can, you know, I would encourage anyone to look at anything, even, you know, whether it's business or personal, that you can outsource so that you can then spend that time on something either that earns you more money and grows your business, or it's perfectly fine to go use that time to relax and energize and do something that you love so that when you do go work on your business, you're that much more energized and focused at it. So that is something, if I could go back to my earlier self, it would be like, you know, it would be to help break through my limiting beliefs about bringing other people on. And now, you know, we've brought a couple of people on that are there. I mean, their skills blow me away. And I'm like, I wish I'd found them years ago. And, you know, once they learn an aspect of the business, they do half of it better than I do. Mm-hmm. So I was holding myself back for years.
Well said. I'm a mentality. Multifamily is a team sport. Now let's take a quick time out to hear from our sponsor.
Gino, I know a lot of our listeners are wanting to take their multifamily investing business to the next level. I know that you've been hard at work helping Jake and Gino students do just that using our framework. Can you explain to the listeners how they can get our help?
Guys, we've been hard at work growing our community of like-minded investors, and the results of our members has been nothing short of incredible. We're looking to grow this amazing group. What we're looking for is those who want to follow our proprietary framework that we've created. Buy right, manage right, and finance right. Leverage our connections, education, and mentorship as ways to take your business to the next level.
So if you're interested in finding out more about how you can become a part of our amazing community, apply to work with us at jakeandgino.com/apply.
All right, we're back. Southern California, you know, surfing in the morning, snowboarding in the evening. What is your best habit for success? I ask everyone this and just want to hear, is there anything that you do that has really propelled you and you're like, man, should have been doing that my whole life, but glad I found it now.
I'm going to go rogue on you and give two answers. One is just that relentless persistence that we talked about, like the, I'm going to make, if I have to make 5,000 phone calls to get this done, right? That is that habit of just committing to that. But as far as like a daily habit that I'd say anybody can do, I think I picked this up from Getting Things Done. I can't believe I'm blanking on the author. It's Dave Allen, I believe, is Allen. Getting Things Done. But I do a weekly plan and review. So I have annual goals. Those are broken down to quarterly, and then those are broken down to monthly. And then on each Saturday night, I review what happened the past week, and then plan out the next week. Like, what are my top three most important things to accomplish in this coming week? And then I schedule all of my tasks and calls and everything for the entire week in advance on Saturday, right? Now, granted, things come up, right? You know, there's a problem with the contract or, you know, whatever. You got to leave space for that. So I plan the week out. And then every night, the last thing I do before I turn off the computer is plan out the next detail. So I pull up my calendar, I pull up my task list, and then sit there and combine that. And the entire, when I wake up in the morning, the entire day is scheduled out from beginning to end. And that includes fun.
The yellow brick road.
Yeah. And so I don't it helps reduce decision fatigue. Oh, what should I do? You know, because what happens is you tend to end up going to whatever's yelling at you the loudest, which might not be the most important or most valuable thing. Every night, the last thing I do is sit down and say, okay, here's the 15 things in order, you know, that I'm going to do tomorrow. And there is flexibility in it. Things don't always go to the minute, but I found that incredibly helpful.
Stephen Covey's Quadrant 2, setting up your day, right? It's amazing how you're proactive and you want to do things that are maybe they're urgent, but they're not important. However that looks like, you're doing things that you're planning your day. You know what you need to do. And I know Jake's going to jump in here and show you his card stock, because you guys are birds of the same feather.
Nope, you jumped in on me. Not doing it. Not showing it. I will say this, though. In 2007, I started doing exactly that. Every Sunday morning, I spent anywhere from 1 to 3 hours planning out my next week. Yeah. Every day is detailed down to the hour. Same thing doing the review, and that changed my life. And I said earlier that this stuff is not rocket science. You take 100% responsibility for your life. You start planning out every hour of your week and you know where you're going. And then you follow that up with relentlessness. The only reason Gino and I have multifamily apartments is because we stuck in there for almost 2 years before we got our first deal. Same thing with you burning up the phones, you know, 4,000 calls to, you know, whoever you were calling to get those deals. You do these things, okay? These are the building blocks for success, and you don't quit. I don't want to oversimplify this, because then there's the things that we talked about, the buy right and the manage right, finance right, the parameters that you put in place. Then once you get to that point, you have, you know, a couple of deals, then it's people, systems, and culture, and a whole new world of interesting things opens up to you. But this is the evolution. These are the inflection points that happen. So you don't need to go nuts with this stuff. Hear what he's saying. Follow the blueprint that's been laid out for so many people, and then follow the yellow brick road. Know where you're going, be organized, and have 100% accountability for everything that comes into your life.
Andrew, I can't get him off the cardstock. I can't get him on the damn Google Calendar. It's amazing. He still uses that cardstock all the time. It's like, dude, calendar. Nope. No calendar.
I'm on the Google. Okay. It's Google. There. I look at it.
The Google. You see what I'm saying, Andrew?
The Google is there, but you know what? Dude, Old Faithful baby hasn't let me down. And every time I'm on a call, oh, let me see if I can make that meeting.
All right.
10 minutes later, it's like, it's right here, guys. I know. Yes, I can do it, or no, I can't. I don't want to wait 45 minutes to find out. You go into the Google and get lost, and you start fucking looking at some clickbait. All right.
Hey, Jake, if it makes you feel any better, this is the first time I've ever revealed this. And this is first. Here's my daily list. See what it is? It's written on paper, right? Because, dude. And now everything is stored electronically, but there's just something down that list. I can pick it up, grab it. I have it in the car with me. And it's,
that's right.
You know what?
Right,
there's
there,
something
baby.
Really satisfactory about taking a pencil and crossing that
just
off.
Just gonna
like,
say that.
Boom, yes. Done. You know. Yeah, there you go.
I use two devices from the medieval times. I use a pen that I take every time I go into the title company to close the deal. I take a handful of them because I'm a cheap motherfucker. I do get these on Amazon though. Big fat Sharpies. You know, the kind that, look at that fat ones. You can cross that whole thing out because I'm like crazy.
That's what we're talking about.
Knuckle dragger, David Goggins shit, right? All right. So give us a tip for someone starting to scale, because you obviously went from we're doing it all, we're hiring people. You know, give us some meat in there that someone can take back to their business right now that can basically speed things up for them.
Tip for scaling. Don't go it alone. And that has, I'd say that has a lot of manifestations, right? That means go get yourself educated. Go, you know, a lot of the, you know, you guys have a great education program. So, you know, as an example,
it's really good.
Yeah, no, it is. I've heard lots of good things about it. You guys weren't around when I started, so, you know, I had to find another way. But nowadays, you know, there's opportunities. Go get educated to figure out what your strengths and weaknesses are, and go get partners to fill. Don't spend time building your weaknesses. Go find somebody else who's really strong at that, and combine your strengths with their strengths. So educate, partner, learn from others' mistakes. And again, you know, like we said this before, There's really not anything new in real estate. It's all been figured out. Go practice R&D, rip off and duplicate. Find someone who's where you want to be. Learn from them, whether you work for free, whether you pay them, it doesn't matter. And then
can
just
I tell you where to find this person?
Yeah, go for it.
You're looking for the next Gino, the next Multifamily Jedi, October 23rd and 24th. We have the Multifamily Real Estate Conference of the Year, Multifamily Mastery 4 in Orlando. Yeah, that's our event. You'll find the next person there. Just saying. Shameless plug.
No, and you know what? So after I had been in the business for a while, I would still occasionally go to meetings like what you just described, just to meet potential investors and potential partners and potential deal finders. This business, if it's a lonely business, you're doing it wrong. Mm-hmm. You've got to network. You've got to meet people. It is very much a team sport. And the bigger your team in all senses of that word, the more successful you're likely to be.
So you mentioned a book a minute ago. I'm taking it that you're a reader. Maybe you're an Audible guy. I don't know. Anything else that you've read in the last couple of years that would positively impact someone else's life?
Yeah. Let's see. I mean, we talked about Gina, we were talking earlier about, you know, just saying no and kind of simplifying things. And one of my favorite books it's older, it's by Jim Camp called Start With No. Mm-hmm. It's about negotiating. I find that book incredibly useful and helpful in real estate. And then Chris Voss's Never Split the Difference came out more recently. And
he's a badass.
Yeah, he's awesome. And he actually references Jim Camp.
I thought you were going to say reference Gino, but anyway, sorry.
not yet.
No, Gino was, I think there was a footnote about you on page 78. So, you know, those two books are great for negotiating. Everyone's heard of How to Win Friends and Influence People. You know, those are books that I review almost every single year. There's another real fun one, kind of more for the general entrepreneur, called Mistakes Millionaires Make. And it's like 30 entrepreneurs who made millions, lost it all, and then rebuilt it back. And then what were the lessons that they learned from that? It's not real estate specific, but there's a lot of stuff in there that you can apply and be like, oh, wow. Okay. Want to make sure I don't do that.
Love it. Learning from the greats there. Tell us how listeners can get a hold of you and if you have any exciting deals or anything, any cool projects coming down the line.
Yeah. Best way to get a hold of me is, if you just Google Andrew Cushman or Vantage Point Acquisitions, it's usually the top result. Website is vpacq.com. So, you know, best way, I mean, you can, of course, I'm on LinkedIn and all of that, Bigger Pockets, but if you actually, you know, want to really connect, get a conversation, there's contact us form on the webpage, and that comes to my inbox, and happy to connect people that way. And I'm excited about the market. I mean, as crazy as it is, I really do think if you buy right, finance right, and operate right, there still are a lot of good opportunities in the right places going forward. We just got an offer accepted last week, just one-on-one. No one else saw it, and we're super excited about that opportunity. And it is competitive and it is hard, but if it was
anything
hard,
that's worth it is, folks.
Well, yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I was gonna say is, you know, there's a lot of value in it because it's hard. It's simple, but it's not easy. So
Gino, take us home, good sir.
Jake, I know you like the alliterations, so let me try to provide an alliteration for you. Andrew Cushman, a young chemical engineer, starts work at a cushy job at Cargill. And one day he goes into his office.
Cushman was cushy at the Cargill.
His elbows shaking. He's saying to his boss, you know, you're my bro, but I think I'm out of here.
What?
Gets on the phone. 4,576 phone calls. I would have quit after 2,000, but you know what? He's an engineer and he's crazy. He decides he gets his first deal. And the amazing thing is he makes more money in that first flip than he did at his job. But I think Andrew ultimately sees the benefit in real estate, goes into his first multifamily in, of all places, Macon, Georgia, at $7,500 a door. And everyone says, you can't lose money at that price. You may not be able to lose money, but you're going to lose some hair and you're going to get some grays, right? And he progresses from learning from that first deal and getting onto other deals. And I like the story about his inflection points, about the journey through real estate and the limiting beliefs that he's gone through, buying something from $7,500 a unit. Now, if you think about it, five units that he bought cost more than his entire first deal.
That was his renovation budget per door now.
Yeah, probably. Exactly. So
that's a good perspective.
That is great, my friend. That's why I got Jake on, bro. He's got all these perspectives thrown at me.
I'm the support man. I'm here. All right? I'm your John Stockton, kid.
And it's just an amazing story. You know, starting out in corporate, finding out what his passion was, knowing that that wasn't working right, the vending machines and all that, getting into real estate, and ultimately progressing and becoming a really big investor in real estate.
Boom, shakalaka. Andrew, this was fun. Enjoy your surfing and your snowboarding, and maybe some folks will catch you on the slopes or at the beach. Have a great rest of the year, and thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Andrew.
Great talk with you guys. Take care.